Where do we start this? An answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. Sure. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, best-selling author of The Little Red Book of Selling.
And I'm Jen Gluckow, founder of Sales in a New York Minute. And this is Sell or Die, a show all about discussing the real world of sales. No bullshit, no tricks, just how to make sales on the street, whether you're in Biloxi or Brussels.
We call it Sell or Die because you're either selling or you're dying. There's no in between. Second place in sales, first loser. Either you're in the groove or the other guy is, and we want you to be in the groove.
We're going to discuss topics that are relevant to you now and in the future. We're interviewing the best minds on selling and personal development, and we're going to take your questions. If you have questions for us, tweet us at Gittimer or at Jen in a New York Minute.
That sounds so unrehearsed.
Well, we're going to take their questions. I want them to tweet us, Jeffrey. Don't you want them to tweet us?
Yes.
Okay. Or go onto our Facebook, facebook.com/Gittimer or facebook.com/Jen in a New York Minute, and use the hashtag SellOrDie. You can listen to us live Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time at blogtalkradio.com/sellordie. Subscribe to us on iTunes or any of the popular podcast apps. Just search Sell or Die and have episodes downloaded to your computer or mobile device so that they're there when you're ready.
We're also joined by our producer, Mr. Hive Talk Live, and voice of the common customer, Doug Branson. Hello, Doug.
Hello to both of you from beyond the glass, and hello to anyone who is watching us live on Periscope as well. Jennifer and Jeffrey, what's going on in your sales world?
A lot.
Oh, yeah. We're in Charlotte, North Carolina at the moment, but we fancy ourselves pretty much New Yorkers. And we talked today with the kid from Sales Hackers, Max. Max Altshuler, great kid, and he just, you know, pulled Sales Hacker out of his butt and made it a success. And
well, he was working his butt off.
That's
I don't
correct.
Know if he pulled it out of his butt.
Okay, but he's going to rock and roll. And we talked to him today about the possibility of doing a live public seminar in Manhattan with me and Jen and Max.
And 500 of you guys.
And at least 500 of you guys. And if you want to find out about it, email jeffrey@gittimer.com and I'll get you more info.
Ooh, straight to the source.
Wow.
Come That's on, bold. Find me.
Jeffrey, you're going to answer
me.
All those emails?
Come on, I'll bold. Answer both of them. Oh, so we have a saying around here.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's coffee is for closers. Coffee is the key to our business and to our podcast. That's why we have a dedicated team. Oh, that's why we have this. I can't read all caps, by the way. We need to go serif face.
Okay, we'll work on it.
Okay, cool. That's
why
we
have a dedicated team of coffee drinkers.
No, I just talked to Mike Brown this morning. He's the CEO of Death Wish Coffee, and he is going to be our sponsor. And I'm using this Greek coffee cup we're happy to serve. It is a symbol of New York City coffee. But they are the greatest. Death Wish Coffee, world's strongest coffee, deathwishcoffee.com. They had a Super Bowl commercial. They won a contest, and they won $1 million commercial and another $1 million to put it. It's Vikings on a ship on their way to war. But the reveal is that they were in a cup of Death Wish Coffee all along. Here it is.
The day of reckoning is upon us. My brothers, what is life if not to die a glorious death? Fear not, for tonight we drink in the halls of Valhalla. Grow, awaken, and welcome death.
Death Wish Coffee, fiercely caffeinated.
They have 100% no bullshit money back guarantee. We drink it in the studio
all the time.
Yeah, when we do the show and we're working, this is the best coffee on the planet. So go get your first bag of the world's strongest coffee at deathwishcoffee.com.
And if you don't think Super Bowl ads work, they had 150,000 people hit their website within the first minute after the commercial ran. 150,000 hits in a minute. Go
That's
for that one, boys.
That's a lot of coffee.
Oh, yeah.
That's a lot of coffee.
Coming up, we have an outstanding show. First, we're going to talk with a saleswoman who stared adversity in the eye, risked everything, and made it in the toughest city in the world, Gloucester, New Jersey. Oh, wait, New York City, New York. And we're going to find out how and why.
And our second guest has a new book coming out, and it's all about how to get in front of your customers and stay on top of your competition. David Averin later in the show.
And don't forget, you can call us with your questions. You can call us right this very minute with your questions, 646-668-8876. I'm going to give it to you again, 646-668-8876. Okay, let's get to it. Sell or die. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Jeffrey.
What season is it?
All right. It's summer almost. June's here.
Wow.
Summer's ramping up.
Where the hell did May go? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. May is long gone. So wedding season is in full swing.
Seriously? I hadn't noticed.
That's what happens now.
I just got back from one.
I hadn't noticed.
It's like all over my Facebook page, on the planet. Yeah,
got
and
it.
Engagement. Anyway, in honor of that, we're
Did
talking
I
about-
I hadn't noticed?
Yeah, really? Are you sure?
I hadn't noticed.
Maybe it's not here for you.
Yeah, it could be.
So in honor of wedding season, we're talking about making the leap. Not the leap into matrimony, but the many leaps we take as salespeople, sales managers, entrepreneurs. The risks of taking on a new client, cold calling, that's a risk, scary, starting a new business.
Mm-hmm.
Salespeople deal with them every day. Jeffrey, what are the most difficult risks you see salespeople struggling with today?
Taking a chance to get to the decision maker, taking a chance to not even go to the person that doesn't decide first and going right to the decision maker. I think the biggest risk that they take is asking for the sale. I think they're scared to death to ask for the sale because they don't want to hear no.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think also just getting into sales is a risk.
Yeah, but you kind of – first of all, they want the money. There's a lure that salespeople make a lot of money, so they think, oh, boy, it's glittery. The light bulb is bright. Let me run to the light bulb.
Yeah, but – you only make a lot of money if you work your ass off.
Yeah, but let me tell you something. You may not risk being a salesperson, but you go through the training and now it's all of a sudden that you have to go out and make a sale. That's a way bigger risk
hitting
the street.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion. Fear of your manager telling you have to make 100 cold calls a day, right?
That is scary.
Exactly.
Who wants to cold call?
So the question is, where'd these fears come from? And the question is, not where do they come from, but where did they grow up? Because the fears may be manifest for the fact that their mom and dad had safe jobs and sales is a risk. You know, you're pretty much eat what you kill.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole risk factor involved in it. That's why good salespeople make good money and great salespeople make great money and shit salespeople make shit money. Right, exactly.
That's pretty true.
Yeah. And so, okay, so if you're a salesperson and you're feeling a little risky or feeling a little at risk, what do you think you can do to overcome the risk, Jen?
I would take training and personal development to learn how to be the best salesperson on the planet.
Mm-hmm. And develop maybe a little self-confidence.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course. I would go out there and talk to some of my top clients to figure out why they're working with me.
Mm-hmm.
What they like about it. That would instill confidence in me hearing it from the client.
If they're a new sales guy, they can still go out and talk to existing customers.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And I would practice.
So one more thing. There's a note to any – I'm not reading this. A note to anyone watching on Periscope. Head over – is this where we cut Periscope?
Sure, we can. But
I don't want to cut Periscope.
Periscope, we love you.
Yeah.
But we have to cut you soon. It says so in our thing.
Right, exactly. So You can go to blogtalkradio.com, blogtalkradio.com/sellordie. And you can catch the rest of the show. We don't want to periscope everything because we don't want to give away the deep, dark secrets.
Okay, but before they go.
What?
There's a few more risks we should talk about because they may relate to them.
The risk of marriage?
Well, that's your fear.
I got it. Okay.
I'm sure some of them are fearful of that,
I'm sure you're not.
But
signify by honking your horn.
Okay. But a lot of entrepreneurs are listening to us. And before they started their own business, they were, a lot of people had fear to abandon their cushy job or their safe job and take that leap to start your own business.
I would say that that's partially correct.
Okay.
Because if your dad has his own business or your mom has her own business, you've already kind of grown up with it. Mm. I always knew I was going to be in business for myself. I had a job working with my father. I went to a rock concert one night and I go, I can do this. All these people, they bought an act, they rented a hall and they put the show on.
Yeah.
And I did.
Cool.
So I did a couple of them and I found out that unfortunately everyone's a drug addict and a liar, but that's a whole other issue. But in the meantime, I put on 2 rock concerts just from balls because I knew I could do it.
Yeah, but you have balls. You have sales balls.
I have sales balls, but my dad was in
the— We sell those, by the way.
Yeah, we do. They come in pairs. My mother and father were both business people, and I knew that I could just do like them. I was as smart as they were.
Jeffrey, not everyone has your balls.
Not yet. Not yet. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Not yet.
I'm the only.
Wait. So what, hold on. You're telling me, Jeffrey, you didn't have any fears related to sales, even in the earliest wee babe years of your sales.
That's correct. Okay. Never had a fear.
Well, we had a bunch of advisors come to who quit their jobs.
Yep.
And they.
Yeah, they risked it.
They spent a weekend studying from you, learning how to deliver your content.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all, a bunch of them were in the same place starting a new business. And they were scared.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely an anxiety. I don't know whether I would call it scared.
It's
I would say
a risk.
They were excited about it as well.
No, they were totally excited. They were eager. They were ready. And they're great people.
Okay. So let's talk about you, the listener, right now. Mm-hmm. What are you scared of? What are you excited about? And how can you turn that fear into enthusiasm to be able to take on the risks and overcome it? Half of fear is false evidence appearing real. And you think about it enough and you're scared. You wake up in the middle of the night, oh my God, what am I going to do? And the answer is you're going to do something.
Ken,
do
you think that customers can smell fear on a salesperson? Can they know, like, this guy is not ready for prime time?
Oh, yeah. If the salesperson is not looking confident, then absolutely you can
Without
smell fear.
If you're fumbling or you're making some lame excuse, or even if you're something stupid like late.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's all kinds of telltale signs that a salesperson gives that they're either not ready or they're scared to ask for the sale.
Right.
I mean, you know, let's face it. Not all salespeople have chutzpah. Many of them have fear of retail.
All right. So last week we talked to Pamela Barsky, whose novelty bag business online and in New York City is a long and winding retail sales journey.
What's that music?
She risked everything.
It's Pamela Barsky's music. She has.
I know. It's we're queuing
she
her
has
up.
Walk
we're
on
queuing
music.
Her up. All right.
I love this.
Okay. So she risked everything and didn't let adversity stop her from making her sales career a success. Take a listen.
Pamela Barsky is a designer, a creative, a New York retailer whose clever makeup bags and all kinds of other bags have bagged her a lot of sales, but it wasn't always easy. She's gone from plan A, an idea, to plan C, creativity, to plan D, dominate.
And she dominates. We were walking through the Union Square Holiday Market.
Wait a second. I walked through the Union Square Holiday Market by myself. I found this stuff and I said, Jen, you have to see this. This is like the coolest place on the planet.
You're so girly.
I'm sorry. But I did.
And he was sending me all sorts of pictures because I wasn't even there yet.
Right. I thought this was like the coolest store. There's 150, 250 stores at that Union Square Market for Christmas.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to stand out.
Yeah, but clearly there were more people in Pam's booth than Pamela's booth than there were in anybody's booth.
Both because her bags were awesome and also because of how it was merchandised. It was, you wanted to look and see what else was there. I wanted to read every bag.
Right, and things were inexpensive. You know, you could buy a Christmas gift for somebody for $20 or $30.
Exactly. All right, anyway, joining us from New York City, Pamela Barsky. Pamela, welcome to Sell or Die.
Well, thank you so much, and hello from New York.
There are very few people that we have done business with who have actually become like a fantasy person for us. We love your stuff. We give away your bags as presents. We use use your bags in my sales training setup and stuff. And Jennifer uses your bag for what it's supposed to be done, makeup and cool stuff that girls do.
Yeah, but I put all my electronic cords in them, too. Everything goes in them.
They're the most useful things on the planet. And for those of you listening, but you can't see the bags, when the show is over, immediately go to PamelaBarsky.com, BARSKY, and you'll see like all these amazing cloth bags. What's the cloth you use? Canvas cloth, right?
We use very thick canvas. It's almost as thick as what they would make a sail out of for a sailboat. We make them in our little tiny factory studio in Chinatown here in New York. We make them in, maybe 250 square feet. And we start with fabric. We cut it. We print it. We sew it. We turn the bags right side out. And then we sell them.
I have a bathroom that's 250 square feet. So you started in the retail business when you were 28 years old, and you've been in it for 2 or 3 years now?
I think almost five now.
Okay, cool. But what made you wanted to start a business when you were that young?
Well, I always wanted to start a business. I come from a long line of entrepreneurs. And when I was in advertising, and it sort of was done with me. And I thought, well, now is the time to have my dream. And I sold my mother's engagement ring and was off.
That's incredible. I love risk. Like, that's a huge risk. It's a one-shot deal.
Well, and the interesting thing was, because it was really the only thing I had of my mother's, I knew I couldn't mess up, because it's one thing to sell your mother's engagement ring. It's another to sell it and have it turn into nothing. So I always had to keep it going, because that was the memory of my mother.
Wow.
That's sort of sappy. Okay, yeah. Now we can cry.
It's not sappy. It's not sappy. It's real. Don't worry about it. It's fine.
Yeah. So how did that go? Tell us more about that business.
Well, so I had a store in LA for 10 years, and it was pretty fantastic. I then started manufacturing things. We had a really big earthquake in LA, and everything in my store got broken, and I didn't really have a lot of ready cash to sort of replace things. So I started making things, and then other store owners started coming in my store and scouting. And I thought, I recognize that tone in their voice, because I have a store. I scout other stores. These people want to buy my stuff. So I took a booth at a trade show and just started selling the stuff wholesale. And then I closed my store. I thought, this wholesale thing is way better. I did that for a while. And then when I moved to New York, that the economy had changed, and I thought, New York is a really great retail environment. It sort of grew from there. So it's sort of been an up and down. It hasn't just been an upward trajectory, let's put it that way.
So I want to go back to what you said before. You were saying that in the early part of your career, you didn't have a plan B. Is that, you just had to make it. Is that something you recommend for other entrepreneurs?
It is. If you have a plan B, you will always, you'll just always in the back of your mind know that there's another option. For me, I couldn't fail. I didn't know what else I was going to do. And that has continued throughout my life. I have to make this work because nobody else wants to hire me. So I just make it work. And I think it's a really, really great way to be successful, because you just have to be.
So you have this earthquake, which most people do not have in their business plan. You wrecked your store, and you decide to move into wholesale. But then you had to get creative so that other people would want to buy your stuff, correct?
I'd already been starting to make things because I was having trouble finding cool things to sell in my store. I was known as the store that always had the newest, coolest thing. And after a while, people want things faster than you can find them. So I thought, well, I'll just make them. So I had started exploring that and had bought some equipment to start making things, but I really hadn't done it yet. So I just kicked into high gear and within 2 weeks had kind of a store full of, they were journals at that time. We were making blank journals out of old books. And then I moved into what they now call a themed journal, where we said, this is a travel journal. And then we printed on the pages so people didn't have to be creative and write things. They just had to fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a big line of those.
You were ahead of your time. Those are so popular now.
I started that and then realized the big guys sort of came along and were able to do it bigger and faster and cheaper than me. So, yes, I was a little ahead of my time. But I did learn from that people like when I put funny things on things, and have learned that products from Pamela have to have funny things on them because people don't want to buy them if they don't. So it's a good lesson.
Now you're in New York City, back in retail, designing these amazing bags that are flying off the shelves. Why New York City, of all places?
I was visiting New York, sort of trying it on for a month, and I met the man who is now my husband, and we spent 2.5 weeks together, and I went back to L.A., sold my house, and just moved here. He's never leaving New York, so I knew it was either not New York or New York, and I picked New York. So here I am, and I knew I had to make it work, and it's a tough place here. So I started hustling and selling my bags in the basement of the church on 14th Street on a Saturday and Sunday craft fair. And then I moved to a bigger, better church. And then I moved to a temporary market in Chelsea Market. And then I moved to a full-time market in Chelsea Market. And then I moved to the holiday markets. And now I do all of those things. Plus, we have an independent standalone store on McDougal Street.
Tell me, though, about the differences that you found immediately between Los Angeles and New York.
Well, in Los Angeles, people don't like to buy things until they've read about them or been told about them being fantastic. So if someone would read about it in a magazine article or a newspaper article, they would come in with that article in their hand and they would say, I want this. In New York, people love to discover things. So, for example, in the very beginning, I was selling on the street outside of Eataly, which is a big Italian food market here. And people would come up to my stand, and not only would they buy my bags, they'd invite me to dinner. So here, there's a pride of, I found something new, I found something exciting, and I'm the first one. So people aren't afraid to spend their money on something that they haven't heard about. In fact, they prefer to do that. So it's almost exactly the opposite.
So when people are looking at your bags, there's 1, 2, 3, 10 that they connect with. They immediately say, oh, I love that one. That's me. That's me. That's me. How do you figure out what people are going to connect with?
Well, it's a little tricky. So when I'm in the store myself, I make it a point to greet everybody like it's a dinner party. And, you know, often I'll listen for an accent. I'll try to figure out where they're from. I'll look at what they're wearing. I get some clue about them. And then we start a discussion, and the next thing you know, they're talking about it's their sister's birthday, and then I'll point out our variety of sister's bags. Often I will just point blank, say, hey, tell me something about yourself, or tell me something about the person that you're wanting to buy something for, and they say, oh, they like to eat, and then, you know, oh, good, I like to eat too, and then I'll show them all the bags about food. So I'm not shy, and I'm not afraid to ask people to tell me their deepest, darkest secrets, and then they do, and then we find a bag that matches it. It's actually the easiest part.
When you have that, you immediately begin to connect with someone emotionally, and then they're willing to make that emotional decision. And the logical justification for under $20 is the zero. You know, I like that. I'll take it. In fact, I'm going to take one for my mom.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm going to take one for my mother. I'm going to take one for my husband. You hear that all the time, don't you?
I do. And I do often point out that they fit very handily into suitcases without weighing a lot. And that usually sort of cinches the deal. We get, I would say, 93% of our business is tourists. So the fitting into the suitcase is very important.
So being in retail in New York City is high risk, high pressure, high reward. How does that affect?
Yeah, you forgot one high, the high rent.
High rent, exactly. And also,
which means you have to do high volume.
And you're very space restricted here, so you need to be efficient.
Wow. Okay, so being that you have to be so efficient in such a small space, how does that affect how you manage your sales team?
I try to let my salespeople have their own personality and do their thing. We really don't have anyone who doesn't know how to engage people. We're very careful when we choose our employees that they're ebullient, would be a good word. They need to be able to speak to a wall. In fact, I would describe most of my employees as people who could have a conversation with a wall if they needed to. So once we've got that down, they're pretty much on their own. I tell them you're at a dinner party. It's called the Pamela Barsky dinner party, and just talk to people like they're guests of yours. And it seems to work. I have one employee who just speaks in bag sayings. Like every sentence out of her mouth is something that's written on a bag. She's just sort of internalized it. So it's really more a matter of finding the right people who are a little quirky and a little funny and not afraid to talk to strangers and just letting them go.
But the customer walks into the store or walks by your booth and is enthralled by all the sayings. So you see them looking or reading at all these sayings. When do you sort of bust in and go, what resonates with you? Or, you know, what's the first question that they ask?
So we make sure that we greet every single person the moment they step up. And often that means sort of like a whole crowd of people and speaking to them all at once and you know, sort of speaking in group speak. But then we have to let them read, because if you interrupt them while they're reading, they will walk away. So it's greet, reading time, and then you just start to sense when they're getting a little confused or overwhelmed, and that's when we ask, is there someone specific you're trying to buy for? Or I see you like this one and you like this one. Have you seen this one over here? It's very similar. And that gets the conversation started. So it's sort of talking and then silence and then talking again. And we don't close the sale. We wait for someone to tell us that they're done. On occasion, we do lose a customer who just likes the bag so much and walks away without buying something. We never let them go without a card. And I would bet that at least 50% of those go online and buy. And I'll always get a little note on the order that says, you know, I wanted to buy this at your shop and I didn't. And then I didn't have time to come back and I should have, because now I have to pay shipping. So now we actually often say to people, you know, you're going to want this. You're going to leave here and you're going to get on the airplane and you're going to want it. And it costs more to get it mailed to you. So you should just get it now. We're very funny and kind of smartass. Because what we do.
The smartass remark is, so if you're a cheap bastard, now's the time to buy because you're going to have to pay freight.
Well, and I will often just say to someone that we have a slight discount here in the store off the website price, so you should buy it now because it's a better deal. And it works sometimes. You have to read the people. Sometimes people don't want to be told to do what to do. Sometimes they just hand you the bag. I mean, before you can even open your mouth to them, they just hand you a stack of 10 bags. And sometimes you really have to reel them in. So it depends on who they are, where they're from, how much English they speak. We get a lot of people who English is not their first nor their second language, so it takes them a little while to understand what the bags is. And often we translate. I speak a little French. My employees have all learned how to count in Italian, so we can say prices in Italian. So we do our best to throw in a we or a China. There's a few words that are hard to explain, like people want to know what but means in French. So I had to learn how to. It's actually plural. It's les fosses, which I think that's what les. So I don't know. And it's plural, but it's plural in French. But I had to learn that because people ask all the time.
Speaking of different languages, you're a big traveler. Do you think your travels have helped you become a better business person, a better creator?
I would say both of those things. I really, really love to travel to really foreign places where life is very different. And I really love to go into grocery stores and markets and see how people scrape together a living in all sorts of different places. And I really internalize that. I think it's super important for people to realize that life is not as easy as it is here, and that there's lessons to be learned from people who have to work much harder than we do. That said, when I'm coming home on the airplane, my brain is afire with ideas because I've seen so many things. I've tasted so many things. The colors are different. The people are different. The language is different. The water is different. Everything. And it somehow just makes something click in my brain. And I will usually come home and do 10, 20, 30 new styles after a trip.
So you're a traveled person. You're a seasoned person in business. And you have tons of sales and life experience. And so I'd like you to share with our listeners, do you have a strategy, a best sales strategy that you would want to share to our audience that has been your deciding factor in sales? You have people walk up to your business booth all the time. They look at your product. What's your best way to talk to them to get them to buy?
Well, I think you need to engage people on a natural level. You can't get that salesman tone in your voice. You can't talk to them like a machine. You have to find somewhere where you can relate. And I think that every single person can relate to every other person somewhere. That said, I think you either need to give them one fantastic thing to buy, or you need to give them a gigantic choice of things to choose from. In between is a more difficult place. So if you make a store and you have one thing that's the most amazing thing on the planet, it's really easy to sell it to someone. On the other hand, if you have 1,000 of the most amazing things, it's easy to sell them. If you've got three, I find that a tougher sell. So I think you need to have the right variety, and then you just need to reach out to them on a real level, and you'll get them not every time, but lots of almost every time.
I really want to thank Pamela Barsky. That was awesome. You can find her on Twitter and Instagram at Pamela Barsky. You can take a look at some of her amazing products on her website, Pamela Barsky. That's B as in boy, ARSKY.com.
Yes.
Why isn't yes? Right. PamelaBarsky.com. Or visit her store the next time you're in New York City. And now I think we have a caller on the line. Hi, Helen.
Hello, this is Helen.
Hi Helen.
Hi. How are you?
Where are you from, Helen?
Where are you calling us from?
I'm calling you from New York City. Oh, and cool. I love Pamela's bags.
Yeah.
Oh, I own cool. some of them.
Oh, cool. So do we.
We do too.
We have something in
great.
Common. Where did you buy them? Did you buy them at the Christmas place or did you buy them at her store?
I did. I bought them at the Christmas market, which was actually my first sales job in New York.
Oh, wow.
My working at a holiday market selling jewelry.
Oh, neat.
How'd you do?
So what? I did great. And now it's trying to transition that into B2B sales, which is why I'm calling you today.
Oh.
All right. Tell us what's up.
Because I could get people to buy jewelry.
Oh, so the hell with Pamela Barsky. This is all about Helen, correct?
Yes. No, but I would like to ask Pamela. She's still on, right?
Nope.
Of course. No?
Nah, we ditched her.
I'm stuck with the two of you.
You can ask us a good question.
Yeah, we'll try our best to answer.
Okay. And if we can't, Doug will take over.
Exactly.
Awesome. So my question is, how do I make the switch from the relationship to ask to making the sale and doing business? Because I've been struggling with that at work. I make great friends with people, but as far as making business happen, it's not happening.
Do they know what you do, or are they just your friends?
They know what I do. I think they think that my sale is a long-term sale and they want to use our product someday, or at least that's what I'm leading them to believe. So I need to make it more immediate.
Can you do a let's try
but
it?
But I need your help.
Can you do a let's try it? Can you do like a, hey, every Thursday I do a live demo, or can I come into your salespeople and do a live demo with them so they can see how damn cool it is, you know.
So let's relate it back to jewelry. So when you were selling jewelry, they were trying it on, right? Looking at themselves in the mirror, seeing how it looked, how they liked it.
You guys are good.
I'm just assuming.
You're together are dangerous.
They pay us big money, Helen. What do you expect?
So this thing that you sell, what is it, by the way?
It's an app for corporate events.
You can't sell an app? This is app world. We live in a freaking app world.
Well, she's saying she's too good at the relationship.
I don't sell an app, actually. I sell the ability for companies to unlock the magic of their people.
Gotcha. Okay, so let me just throw this at you as easily as I possibly can. The more you involve the person, the more you engage the person, the more you don't demo it. Let them demo it themselves.
Right, like the jeweler, let them try it on.
And
I love that.
And once you do that, you get them involved and engaged, and you say, this is what it's like in your classroom or your training program. Now you can try it out. And we would love to find out what happens, Helen. Call us back next week and let us know that you made 3 sales as a result of this, and we will tell you where to send the commission.
Helen, thanks so much for calling in.
Yeah.
Remember, if you're listening live and have questions or comments, just give us a call. We're standing by for your questions. 646-668-8876. That's 646-668-8876.
Can you repeat that? I didn't get it.
No.
I'm just kidding.
Why don't you repeat it?
Okay. So we've just talked about making the leap where Barsky, she's an amazing woman,
she's
by the way.
She's great. Oh, yeah.
She made her leap. Now, you got to make your leap. Let's say you got your feet wet. You're not scared anymore. So now what do you do? How do you get out in your marketplace, rise above the noise that's out there, otherwise known as your competition, differentiate yourself as a leader in whatever you do, your sales, your business, your product, your field. And Jen, you're an expert at making sales in New York City, aren't you? Isn't that one of the noisiest places on the planet?
Yeah.
Noisy,
even at 3 a.m., it's noisy.
Exactly. So metaphorically, what are some of your experiences to cut through the static? That's a
fake static?
Bingo.
Okay, I'm cutting through now.
Okay.
So what I found was that it was in my head first and then in the buyer's head second, meaning that I had to believe in whatever it was I was selling, and I sold all different things. I sold jewelry. I had to believe that I was selling the best jewelry,
mm-hmm.
or else I couldn't show that and demonstrate that, you know, why it was so great to the other person. And so that was number one. And then number two was I always tried to, and I still do, give value.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people out there are just trying to sell whatever it is, whether they believe in it or not, and that's its own problem. So that's number one. Then they're just bullshitting and giving random stuff about the product that the customer doesn't even care about or may not care about. So that's what I did, was show value, and, you know, it worked.
You have to be different. And unfortunately in New York, and we're there a pretty decent amount of time, everyone seems to do the same thing that the other guy does. And I'm going to give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
You go to any restaurant, any coffee shop, any deli, any time of the day or night, and people are willing to stand online ad nauseum to wait to give somebody else their money or to wait to give somebody else their order. They'll wait, a lunch queue.
And by the way, in New York, it's online, not in line.
I understand. So they're willing to stand online and wait for some reason. Well, I don't wait. I'm going to be different by figuring out a way that I don't have to stand online and wait like a schmo. I'm going to go 15 minutes early when there is no line. I'm going to go at 1:30 when there is no line. I don't want to waste my time doing that. I have other things to do in my life. And that ounce of creativity to tell me how it will manifest itself in everything else that you do I can differentiate.
But you do wait for sweet green salad because that is the best salad. And sometimes yes, you do.
I do not.
Okay, well, I do. And guess what they do while you're waiting online? They come around with free stuff and they thank you for waiting online and they hand out...
Rare.
I'm telling you, this is what they do.
I'm just telling you, it's rare.
It is rare, but that's standing out.
Okay, so that's how they differentiate themselves. So
right.
If you have limited resources, give away some of your product. That's the easiest way to explain it, right? Yeah, if you're Mrs. Fields Cookies, you give away a cookie.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're obviously selling cars, then it's a little bit more difficult. Maybe
you
give away a gallon of gas or a free oil change.
Yeah, but you can offer me coffee.
Well, the key is to differentiate yourself. And you differentiate yourself with creativity. And Pamela Barsky has obviously differentiated herself with an inexpensive but high-quality product and something, a saying that anyone can identify with.
Mm-hmm.
Rock the house.
Jeffrey, let's go to our next guest.
Okay. Who is it? Oh, wait, I know who it is. He's my buddy. Our next guest is an author, a speaker, and a friend of mine for many years. He has a new book coming out called Visibility Marketing. And it's full of information that you can use to help create a brand or develop your own personal brand and reputation.
This book for me, and the book is called Visibility Marketing, is sort of the culmination of much of what I've learned over the last 20 years of working with clients, working with businesses, and very much a reflection of how the marketplace has changed in that time and how marketing and sales has changed. I think you look back sort of the early days, we needed salespeople. Salespeople, there was a real role for it. Not to suggest that there isn't a role for salespeople. I just think it's changed significantly. In the old days, it was the open markets and trying to get people's attention to come into your booth. 1940s and 50s, we'd walk into an appliance store, right? And some teenager would tell us about some appliance or the big console stereo. Remember when stereos were the size of a piece of furniture? We'd even walk into a car dealership, much as we do today, but it was different. We'd see a cool car and we'd walk around it and we'd get inside and play with the knobs and pretend we're driving. But then we would motion the salesperson over and we'd say, so tell us about this car. We don't do that anymore. We walk in that dealership. We know everything about that car. We've gone online. We've done the side-by-side comparisons. We've done we know what the features and benefits and maybe some of the incentives. Today, the marketplace has become a grocery store. We walk down the aisles of the grocery store and nobody sells us anything. There's probably no environment when you think of a Sam's Club or a Target or a grocery store, no environment with more products and items, yet nobody is there to sell them to us because the sale already happened in our mind.
That's true. But there are some brands that are more visible than other brands.
Sure.
And so you feel comfortable with those.
Exactly. Well, but that's what it comes down to. Probably no other time has been more essential that we focus on the brand. And so today it really is about the brand. Now we understand, we grew up with brands. You know, those who are in graphic design or marketing or public relations or specialties or whatever else, they talk about brands as if this was this new revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is we grew up with brands, right? Mm-hmm. We bought Kellogg's cereal and we bought Schwinn bicycles, yep. And right, and stayed at a Howard Johnson's.
See the USA in your Chevrolet.
Exactly right. But about 20, 25 years ago, they started talking about brands and branding as sort of a new concept and a new discipline. And it was always B2C. And now it's, you know, then it was more B2B, right? Some of those industrial packaging got a little bit brighter. They learned from their consumer counterparts. And then personal branding, right? We're a brand, apparently. In my world, because I owned a marketing firm 20 plus years ago, it was as if the clouds had parted and the angels were singing and we had discovered this amazing new concept that was going to transform how we marketed our businesses. And then a little time and a little analysis, and we sort of came to recognize it wasn't anything new at all. It was sort of a catch-all term for everything that we've always done, right? Your marketing and your advertising and your public relations and everything. Your brand is, for lack of a better word, is your reputation, right? What are you known for? And as I like to say, to be well-known, you have to be well-known for something beyond your quality and your commitment and your caring and your trust and your great people. And that's really the core of this book, is sort of calling out some of those traditional bad behaviors of, you know, we tend to highlight our competency. We're sort of doing this in a vacuum. We're talking to our prospects. Here's what we're good at. Mm-hmm. And what we forget is everybody else is good at those things, or they wouldn't be in business.
No one's going to say our people are shit. Please use somebody else.
Right. Right. But isn't it, it's interesting as I travel around the world and I ask audiences and I work with CEOs and I work with business owners and others, and I say, why you? And the number one answer by far, they'll say at the end of the day, it's really about the people. Yeah. And I'm like, really? And don't those people bear a striking resemblance to the people who work for your competitors? Stop pretending that your people are your competitive advantage. They aren't. They weren't raised on some special customer service island.
And most of the time they are in some kind of a fantasy world because they answer their phone crappy. They have a computerized, you know, press one if you want to do this.
Right.
Press two
for our convenience, right?
Right. And the people are all allowed to use words like policy and sorry and, you know, I really wish I could help you, but I can't.
Yeah, right.
Right, right. And there's a whole chapter in the book dealing with that specifically, which is identify all the potential barriers to doing business and sit back and pretend you are your own customer. And there's a whole exercise in the book that talks about why do we say no? Why do we say no to customers? And is it because it was some policy from 20 years ago or all the reasons that people say no? I was in Europe. I was in Rotterdam with a big group and we were going out to dinner and there was a huge group of us. So we went in this restaurant. It was about half empty and we started pushing some tables together and the waiter came over and says, no, you can't push those together. We said, well, we have a big group. We'd like to be together. They said, no, but it's a big hassle because then we have to reset the tables and everything else. I'm like, at what point did your convenience as a staff take precedence over our desires as a customer?
So what would you tell? We have a lot of salespeople who are listeners.
Sure.
What would you tell them in terms of how they can build their visibility? What should they be doing?
I think a lot of it is you have to be cognizant of what your competitors are doing and saying. Now, I get pushback on this all the time saying, I'm not going to create my marketing based on what my competitors are. I'm like, are you crazy if you don't? Because we think we're in a vacuum. We think we're having a one-on-one conversation with our prospects. And we talk about how much we care and how much we listen and our great expertise, what we do. And we have those conversations and they say, you know what? Listen, this isn't about a one-time sale. I want to build a long-term relationship. Our customers come first. As a matter of fact, I am going to give you my personal cell phone number. If there's a problem, you call me. What we forget is our competitors having that exact same conversation.
So or is at least capable of having it.
Absolutely. So other sales professionals are hitting up your prospects and saying the same thing, right? Listen, you know, it's about long-term relationship, our customers. Matter of fact, I'm going to do something I don't normally do. I'm going to give you my personal cell phone number, 24/7, right? And by exact same conversation, what I really mean is exact same conversation about our quality and commitment and caring and trust in people and the opportunity for sales professionals and for others in business in a competitive marketplace is to truly step back. Secret shop your competitors. There's a great exercise that I talk about in the book, and it's where you gather up all of your promotional materials, everything you have written about yourself, about what you do, your sales sheets, your brochures, your catalogs, your website pages, print everything off. Then take all of the promotional materials for your top two or three competitors. Now I say, now whether they do exactly what you do, or they just profess to solve the same problem. If they're a choice for me, they're a competitor of yours, right? Don't quibble on that. Secret shop them, get all of their promotional materials and their sales sheets. Now I talk to audiences and most of them say, no, you have all of that, right? For all your competitors, you have all their promotional, and they stare at me. I'm like, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. How are you going to compete until you know what they're saying? So secret shop them. Spend a couple of weeks. Go through the sales process. There's nothing unethical. You're helping them as they're helping you go through their sales process, even if it's a long sales cycle. Request all their materials, send it to a PO box or whatever, gather it all up, spread it out on a table, and then take your team together, give everybody highlighters, and walk around that room playing buzzword bingo. You will be stunned at how similar, if not identical, their claims. So the question is, how do you expect your prospects to know why you are a better choice when you're saying the same damn things as everybody else? That's the first step. When you sort of, you know, to admit that you have a problem and realize that we're highlighting our competency, but to be able to step back. And in the book, Visibility Marketing, I give them a whole bunch of ideas of how to have these conversations with their team, how to look at their competitive landscape and look for opportunities, not only to ferret out what's different, but in quite honestly, in some cases in commodity industries, there really isn't anything that's different. And that's what really spurs you on to say, we need to create some differentiation that wasn't here before. Is there a longstanding complaint or challenge about our industry that maybe we can address better? Because what I hear all the time, and Jeffrey, you and I have had this conversation before, is CEOs and company leaders will get in front of their teams and they'll say, at the end of the day, it is about quality. And I disagree wholeheartedly. At the beginning of the day, it's about quality. That's the entry fee. At the end of the day, it's about competitive advantage. And the book is about competitive advantage.
Jen, what do you think about David? What he had to say about it's all about competitive advantage?
He's totally right. I'm going to have to read that book. I can't wait to get it. I've pre-ordered it. Did you pre-order it?
I have already pre-ordered mine.
Yeah, Amazon.com.
David Avrin. A-V-R-I-N.
Yeah. So being a visible marketer, putting yourself out there, why do you think it's so challenging?
Well, most people don't know how to do it. They haven't taken Visibility 101 in high school. Because high school is too busy teaching you crap that won't work. And then you go on to college and you take liberal arts or you become an English major. And then all of a sudden you're selling copiers for Xerox. And then all of a sudden you find yourself hating that. So you want to go into your own business because you think that's some kind of panacea. You've had no training.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, well, I don't know how to tweeter very well. Is it tweeter or Twitter? Most people are underskilled. And you see very few courses offered.
They don't teach this stuff.
At all.
No.
At all.
No, oh. I went to business school and we learned very textbook-oriented marketing.
Right. And it's known as a good school, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But
it's bullshit because it's totally unusable and the people that teach it have never had a job. Kind of like the president of the United States.
Well, let's not go there.
No, let's not. His job is almost up, whatever it was. So I'm looking at this from the perspective of if you're going to try to be visible, you better learn how to be visible first and then have something visible to say that is different from your competition. Now, I'm going to explain differentiation and we're going to move on. Differentiation or competitive advantage is something that you have that your customer considers valuable, period. If your competition has it or not, if you're looking for an advantage, you better have something that your customer considers valuable. It's time now to head out to Twitter or Facebook and Reddit, where we've teamed up with reddit.com/r/sales. Huh?
Yeah. It's their Reddit. It's their sales subreddit. So it's reddit.com/r/sales.
Oh.
Yeah.
reddit.com/r/sales.
r/sales.
All right, since we're teaming up with them, we should get this right. It's reddit.com/r/sales. A lot of great information on there, Jeffrey. A lot of people coming together to list jobs and ask questions. It's a cool thing.
Yeah.
I'm in.
All right, we've got a
question. So, Doug, do we have any questions?
Yeah, we do.
Is there a question from Reddit?
So, yeah, we've got a question.
Slash
and we're going to be posting a call for more questions as these weeks continue.
Oh, cool.
So we've got one here from Scott Clay 40 on Reddit. Scott Clay 40 is 18 years old, and he's suddenly been thrust into business-to-business sales with no prior experience. He's now selling for a local company that polishes concrete flooring, also does demo, glue flooring, that kind of thing. He doesn't know about the services beyond what they are called. What are the first things he should start to do? This guy sounds like he's a little underwater.
Yeah. He's really been thrust into this.
First of all, go polish a few floors so he can understand what the heck it's all about. Get involved in your product. Be a product of the product. And you walk up to somebody and go, I'm the best floor polisher on the planet. And if I'm not available, I have a team of people behind me that can come and help you. And that's where you start.
I like that.
Yeah, that's where you start.
So that's step one. Should he be messing with CRMs or anything like that?
Well, he should be doing something about his social presence for sure. I mean, he should start a Facebook page and take pictures of all the customers that they have in their floors on a before and after basis. That's what I would do. I would interview a few customers and find out what they've posted and post about
them. Or what they bought.
Yeah.
What kind of floor they bought.
Yeah.
So I like that idea. I would find out not just what they bought, but why they bought it. Why'd they want one floor versus another floor?
The first floor versus the second floor?
Well, they have all these different flooring types, it seems like.
Yeah. Oh, Jen, you're a floor polisher yourself.
Weren't you a floor polisher in a previous life? Yeah, in my previous life, yeah.
But this is the reason I like this question is because it has a lot to do with what we've talked about the entire show. So, yeah. I mean, being in over your head, I felt like Pamela probably experienced that a time or two. And this guy wants to make himself more visible to his market, but he's obviously, it sounds like, you know, this is all new for him. So I wonder if there's just some simple action items.
I will guarantee you if he goes to his local newspaper and says, hey, my job is selling floor polishing and I'm going to be polishing some floors myself so I can learn my job better. Would you mind following me around? I'll guarantee you that kid gets a story in the Sunday paper. He's 18 years old.
He may as well call a radio station too. So yeah. It's on the...
It's like, live. I'm polishing
like
this floor.
7 or 8 a.m.
At 7th and Vine.
I love that. But you know, that happens, right? A lot of people go into a sales job and there's no training. They don't tell them what they need to know. They don't equip them with the right tools. And forget CRMs and other tools like that. I'm talking about the basic knowledge they need to have an engaging and knowledgeable conversation about whatever it is they're supposed to be representing.
So for example, let's talk about this kid.
Okay.
He walks in and he goes, hi. What is his name, Doug?
Scott Clay.
Scott.
I think.
Yeah. So, Scott, hi, my name's Scott, and I sell floor polishing. And or you could walk in and say, when people come in and look at your floors, what do you want them to think? And what are they thinking now? And do you think this rug is safe if there's a rainstorm? I mean, there's all kinds of things that this kid could do to gain some engagement, but he hasn't learned engagement 101. He's too busy trying to make a sales pitch for a floor polish.
Well, he might not even be making sales pitches. He might be scared to make sales pitches because he doesn't know enough about it. So I like what you're saying, Jeffrey. You're saying go in and ask questions or make suggestions about what could happen.
Right. But keep in mind, at 18, most people are saying, do you want fries with that as their closing question? So at least this kid's out there.
So that's good. Like, how do you combat that? Is there any way to combat that? Like, you're too young to be doing this. Yeah. Aspect in sales. That's a big question. We should probably save that for another show.
Yeah. But he should be carrying around a floor polisher and polish the damn floor while the people are looking. I may be too young to sell it, but I can sure show you, how it looks because your floors look shitty.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, since you brought that question up, the only way to combat that question is to prove your worth when you're there and in front of them. Prove that you know what you're talking about. And you don't have to look like you're proving it, but you prove it at the end of the day when you're there for them and, you know, their floor is getting installed. Go. Be the person who's there when they get to see their floor first. Yeah. And keep and maintain that relationship. And all of a sudden, they're not going to think, oh, he's young. They're going to think, wow, he's a relationship guy.
Okay, so Jenny.
Yeah, so... Guys, thanks for listening to the Sell or Die podcast. We're back live next week at our regular time, Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern time. Bookmark blogtalkradio.com/sellordie and come join the conversation that's revolutionizing sales podcasting. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or any podcasting app. Just search Sell or Die.
And this is totally unscripted, but I want to thank our guests, Pamela Barsky and David Averin, especially our producer, the great Doug Branson, and our silent but technical director, Chris Hill.
Until next time, I'm Jen Gluckow.
And I'm Jeffrey Goodman, reminding you, to get out there and sell, even if your ass falls off.